Tonight we kick off this Tuesday evening season with the Museum of Contemporary Art Denver's director and, quote, chief animator, Adam Lerner. Adam has a PhD from Johns Hopkins University and a master's from Cambridge University. He was a fellow at the Smithsonian American Art Museum from 1997 to 1998. And prior to his arrival in Colorado, he was curator of the Contemporary Museum, Baltimore. Also interesting to note, Adam was the founder and executive director of the Laboratory of Art and Ideas at Belmar until the lab merged with the MCA in March of 2009. He has curated dozens of exhibitions and projects with contemporary artists such as Barnaby Furness, Liam Gillick, and Christian Marclay, and also showcased the non-traditional talents of astrobiologists, shamans, and pigeoneers, among others. In a 2012 article for the New York Times, Louis Garchos, the director of the Albright Knox Art Gallery in Buffalo, was quoted as saying that Adam Lerner's work to engage audience is, quote, reshaping what has become a stale model of a contemporary art museum, end of quote. Among many projects, Adam curated the exhibition Orphan Paintings, the inspiration for his book From Russia with Doubt, the quest to authenticate 181 would-be masterpieces of the Russian avant-garde. He also authored the book and curated the major retrospective, Mark Mothersbaugh, Myopia, the first comprehensive look at the polymath co-founder of the band Devo. I should fill you in on the fact that I initially extended an invitation to Adam to be here tonight in conjunction with the Modern's new acquisition, Untitled Sculpture Study, two-part standing construction by Fred Sandback, now installed in Gallery 6 on the first floor. And some of you may remember it just being upstairs. It's a beautiful piece. And thinking that he might speak on Fred Sandback after reading, I thought that maybe Adam would be interested in speaking on Fred Sandback after I read an essay he'd written for an exhibition of the artist's work. It's a beautiful essay, and I thought, oh, this is really touching. I think I'll see if Adam Lerner would be interested in coming and talking to us about this artist and about Sandback and his work. Of course, I also knew Adam to be the, quote, chief animator of the MCA Denver, and that, as explained in the announcement of tonight's presentation, Adam believes that institutions can easily lose their connection to the soul of art, and that he has, therefore, has opted for an unconventional approach to, quote, keeping the sacred impulse alive. So when we discussed my proposal, I mentioned that Andrea Fraser had been here years ago for the same program to read her now famous response to Sandback's work at Dia Beacon. Why does Fred Sandback's work make me cry? How many of you know about that lecture or were here for that lecture? Okay, not as many as I thought, perhaps. You should go back and listen to or watch the... I don't think it's a video. I think it's just an audio, but you should go back and listen to it. It's really good. So anyway, I asked Adam, I told him about that you know, Andrea had been here a while back and that she had done that, and Adam said that he thought that him addressing Sandback's work was, in fact, a good fit, stating that the seriousness of Sandback's work should be a perfect way to explain his own approach to the institution of the museum. So following that, he came back to me with a title for his lecture, which, of course, is Why Does Fred Sandback's Work Make Me Want to Be Ridiculous? So if you would, please join me in welcoming Adam Lerner.
Thank you, Terry. That was a very nice introduction. So just out of curiosity, how many people here are here because you just love France and stand back and want to know as much as you can about him? Okay, good. I'm glad it's not too many. Because it's not really a Fred Sandbach lecture. This is sort of like a long-running start to Fred Sandbach, but it really is sort of Fred Sandbach in many ways is the person I always give as the example for, and maybe even a counterexample for why I do what I do whenever I'm asked to give a talk. So I'm going to start off with a lot of stuff about me at the beginning, but I hope you'll understand why I'm doing that. So, as Terry said, my job is the director of this museum, the Museum of Contemporary Art Denver. And these are my dogs, Christofferson and Kingsley. That's right. And this is my Bitmoji avatar. Hi. And this is the guy who played me when Curious Theater in Denver did a performance based on my life. And this is a picture of my father when he was about my age, and he died in 2000. And without ever having gone to an art museum or, and I probably never saw him smile more than you see here. And it's understandable. He grew up in a place that looked pretty similar to this, in a prison camp, in a labor camp in Soviet Union. And came to America after the war, after World War II, and where he went to the Henry Street settlement in Lower East Side of New York. And he says, he would say something like, I came to America, I knew immediately I had a talent for square dancing. And actually, he picked up square dancing at the Henry Street settlement. And though he was an Orthodox Jew who knew no English coming over here, he dedicated his entire life sort of from that point on to learning how to square dance. And as he became more and more advanced in square dancing, he became less and less observant as a in his religion. And he met my mother, who was a volunteer at the Henry Street settlement, and they danced together. Here are the matching outfits that my mom made for our family. And I was the youngest member of the Brooklyn Square Square Dance Club at age 9. I had a square dance bar mitzvah that began at the Forest Hills Jewish Center for the service. And then we rented out the basement of this building near my house where we had all my friends come for that. And this was right near, not too far from the school I went to, the Solomon Schechter School, where we studied Hebrew half the day and English half the day. And my favorite subject there was Talmud. And there's something I loved about Talmud, where you can spend a full day just trying to understand one sentence of it. And I felt like there was something like the entire richness of and the mystery of civilization embedded within this sacred text, which is all to say that I was a pretty awkward kid. And I think I came more and more to understand that I came from a weird background as I was growing up. And I somehow had that feeling that I wanted to escape. I want to escape my background, which is not uncommon for people. Like, for some people, when they want to escape, by becoming rich. You know, like, I want to drive a Mercedes, and like, that's how I want to escape my background. Or other people, it's becoming famous. That's how I want to be like this on TV. That's how I want to escape this sort of nothing background I came from. But for me, it was my escape becoming cultured. Yeah, I believe that somehow, I don't know, I think I saw these advertisements and like somehow or another, I associated like Ralph Lauren advertisements with being cultured. I don't know why. Like, maybe because I had absolutely no prospect of ever playing sports in any way or ever playing polo. But I just imagined myself carrying these like little leather-bound books, the kind that you see on the store's shelves, like with me in these college classrooms and teaching people, you know, like eager students about philosophy. But I did, that's why I had so much of the education that Terry mentioned. And I got pursued my PhD at Johns Hopkins University with incredible devotion. And, you know, for example, I would, even though it's very, very difficult for me to read, I because of my distraction and perhaps on spectrum of dyslexia, I have to keep write the page number and the time down to be able to keep me a structure. But yet I would still always, I read constantly and would write constantly about what I was reading. And 1 month I remember even like waking up in the morning and reading Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit all day until night, and then doing that over and over again for an entire month. So the kind of work, that's the kind of work I did because I was so bent on becoming cultured, understanding culture. And the subject matter was of my dissertation was maybe ridiculously Mount Rushmore. I know, it's crazy. Or more specifically, the sculptor of Mount Rushmore, Gutzon Borglum. And I spent about 9 months in the archive reading every single letter, everything he ever wrote, just to understand what is his motivation behind what he did. I think the big change for me, I became a fellow doing this work at the Smithsonian American Art Museum, and then I became a curator at the Contemporary Museum. But a lot changed for me at one moment when I met a visitor to the museum who was in town from Europe to in order to be able to give a lecture at the Hirschhorn Museum, and that was the great curator Harald Zeman. And Harald Zeman came to the museum, and I got a chance to meet him, and I saw somebody there who gave me a perspective on curating that felt Talmudic. It felt like something that was familiar to me from my childhood. He talked about the exhibitions that he's curated, specifically his famous exhibition When Attitudes Became Form, this groundbreaking exhibition in the late 60s, where Joseph Beuys produced a work very, very simply that had an audio component to it that was Joseph Beuys simply saying, well, it would be in German, but it's yeah, 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 no, 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 no. And it would repeat this over and over again, and or something like that. And in literary terms, like the idea of yes and no is very powerful. It's the idea of like, yes, there is possibility of transcendence. There is a world beyond this world. There is some hope that we there is something that is not just material. And then no is the idea that like, no, this world that we see around us, this table, this chair, this is the world we have. There is no hope of transcending this world. And Joseph Beuys, as an artist, in some ways wanted both. He wanted to have this, you know, idea that like he went back and forth between like believing and doubting. And the idea that actually an artist can explore those fundamental humanist issues was probably the most meaningful insight of my curatorial career. And I felt like maybe I became a curator really because I was not ultimately, like my father, religious enough to be a rabbi. But I loved the bigness of those ideas that contemporary art could offer. I left the Contemporary Museum in Baltimore and became an educator, a master teacher at the Denver Art Museum. I did that for about 2 years. When things changed for me, when this guy, Mark Falcone, who's a real estate developer, came to the art museum and said he wanted to create a relationship with the art museum. And I had been there for about 2 years, and the director of the Denver Art Museum was like, yeah, well, we brought this guy from Baltimore. We're not really sure what to do with him. And so maybe he can give you some ideas. And I'd like to say that I got my career began in earnest when a would-be real estate developer decided to study art history in college. Because I pitched, he was developing, a real estate developer, development about 22 square blocks in the suburbs of Denver called Belmar. And he wanted to have like some art from the art museum in this development. And I said, why don't we do something more interesting? Maybe we could have art that is, you know, leading contemporary art from around the world, but also we can connect to the fabric of culture in more interesting ways. So instead of thinking about importing the model of a museum into a suburban shopping district, what we can do is maybe invent a new form of art institution appropriate to a suburban commercial context. So remember, even though I had these kind of pretty good ideas, and that was a pretty good idea. I was also really insistent on, you know, getting away from that kind of crazy Jewish square dancing background that I came from, and I still needed to prove how smart I was. I developed the institution that had the sort of serious name of the Lab, Art and Ideas, and for me, it was about this sort of relationship between the sort of what is the intellectual component of art and how it can be connected to the sort of ideas of our culture and how we can create a public dialogue around it. The developer was, you know, interested. He said, like, yeah, this sounds pretty good. Let's do something. He became interested in the art that I was exhibiting, and I collaborated with my colleague at the Pompidou Center in Paris to co-produce a 3-screen film installation of the British artist Isaac Julian. And so we used to say that if you want to see the world premiere of Isaac Julian's film, you would have to go to Paris, to the Pompidou Center. But if you want to see the U.S. premiere, you only have to come to Lakewood, Colorado. And, you know, the space we also exhibited, you know, photographs for it. But to me, this was only half of the equation. There's a part of me that, even though I was very, very intent on this serious art, also felt like that was inadequate. And so I developed this lecture program, and the lecture program was called Mixed Taste. And the idea was that instead of having one lecture in a night, like, you know, say, some museums do, what we did was I'd pair two completely unrelated lectures in the same night. So the program was would be like this one, Andy Warhol and Artificial Lighting. And you have one speaker speak for 20 minutes on his or her subject, the second speaker speak for 20 minutes on his or her subject, and then you have question and answer on both at the same time. So we did this. We started off when the shopping district that this was based in, like, didn't even have a restaurant open. We were used empty storefronts. We had 12 people the first day. This is, like, the second week we did it. We had about 20 people there. I swear half of them were my friends. Then the next week we did it, we had about 40 people there. On the left, you have a speaker speaking about T.S. Eliot. On the right, a speaker speaking about fresh meat sausage. And it's actually a new space. We had to move to a bigger space because we're now getting 40 people showing up. And this is what a sample season looked like: carnivorous plants and color field painting, earth art and goat cheese, capoeira and Le Corbusier, Chinese opera and Alfred Hitchcock, Walt Whitman and whole hog cooking. So we would just develop these titles. I would just develop them based upon how good they sounded. They sounded like that sounds really good. Let's do it. Tequila and dark energy in the universe. soul food and existentialism, prairie dogs and Gertrude Stein. And then the summer blockbuster was Marxism and kittens, kittens, kittens. If you ever talk about Marxism, you'd have like, you know, five grisly graduate students show up. You know, if you have a talk on cats, you'd have like 12 cat ladies there. But Marxism and kittens, kittens, kittens would have had hundreds of people. So about 250 people would show up for our program. And I think that what was starting to happen is that this whole shopping district that it was based in was starting to be colored by the reputation of this little program. We spent, you know, $5,000 on speaker fees and a little bit on promotion. And it was, people were starting to think about this whole area as like a creative place. And I started to get a little bit more confident in my ability to actually, in the side of me that was interested in not just proving that I can be smart and know that I know philosophy, that I know the history of ideas, but also that I could actually disrupt that in some way. That I had that the power, I could use the power of humor to actually create energy that is beyond the seriousness of what is recognized as a cultural program. So, like, we had a motto for the institution, because culture is big, like Canada. And while we had continued to do very exhibitions by artists who are recognized within the field, like this artist, Chinese artist Fang Lijun, we would start to do things like have a sack of rubble in the lobby, and we'd say, "Sacks of rubble, free to new members," and we give them away. And we were across this is a shopping district. We were across the street from a Dick's Sporting Goods. This is our building, and that's their building. Of course, you know, being, you know, who we are, like, I basically, we put a sign in the window saying, "Welcome to the lab. We're not Dick's." And we put their logo there. Until they complained. So we actually published this apology, which was, "The lab apologizes to our neighbors, Dick's Sporting Goods, for the sign in our windows saying we're not Dick's. Apparently we are." So after about 5 years of running this program, we would get 1,000 people to show up to our opening. It was our openings. It was a whole lot of energy associated with this organization. And there was an opening at the Museum of Contemporary Art, Denver. And by this time, like, I was ready, even though I was in a, you know, I had a staff of 3 people working in a shopping district. I found myself at places all around the country talking about the kind of programming we're doing there, because everybody is looking for ways to have sophisticated programming that somehow undercuts pretenses. Like, that it's sophisticated, but it also is fun. And that's like the goal. I mean, for so much of what cultural institutions are seeking these days, and somehow we found a formula for that. So I found myself like sitting at a round table in Washington, D.C. at the Institute for Museums and Library Services alongside the head of the Smithsonian institutions in general, or the head of libraries for the entire state of California. And I had like my 3 employees, you know, and running my little space. And so after doing this for a while, though, I had enough of a national reputation that when there was an opening at the Museum of Contemporary Art, Denver, then I applied and took that position. And there was my opportunity to take all of the lessons that I had learned in that context, in the context of this alternative art space, this experimental space, and bring it over to a more conventional institution. You could also say, like, the class clown becomes the class president. So the lab stayed within the MCA Denver in our logo. That's why we have the lab dog in the added that to the MCA Denver logo. We continued to do our mixed taste programming. where we have to use a space across the street, we use an empty warehouse, where we would sell out this programming regularly at 300 people. We've since moved up to a bigger space that accommodates over 400 people, and we still regularly sell out of that programming, of that program. We've had many spin-offs of it, and I won't go into all the programming that we do. That's not the subject of this lecture. But one spin-off I think is funny. We did one. We have one spin-off called Feminism & Co., where we pair completely unrelated subjects, but specifically on feminism. And as a fundraiser for our feminism program every year, we have an all-men's dinner that's black tie, only meat, and no utensils. So there I was, director of the Museum of Contemporary Art, and I want to just talk about my decision at that point to develop the programming. I had developed a program that was sophisticated at the lab at Bellmar, but also had this element that was playful and always undermining it. I'd always loved the work of Fred Sandbach and knew that I wanted the opportunity to show him. The museum space at MCA Denver was, though not as grand in any way as this museum, which is, you know, really one of the top in the world, it had a simplicity and an elegance to it that I wanted to work with. And so I knew that I wanted to exhibit the work of Fred Sandbach in that space, but I didn't feel like it was appropriate to just give a gallery or even a floor to it. What I decided was the only way to show Fred Sandbach was to give the entire building to him. So therefore, there was nothing else in the entire building but Fred Sandbach. We even put all the labels like in the entry. So therefore, you couldn't see anything but that. And this is a decision that I still have difficulty even articulating why I knew it was the right decision. I think it has to do with something like, there's so much that I felt that Fred Sandbach risked when he made this art. There's so much that he had to have so much courage he needed in order to be able to make art that looked nothing like the sort of massive, masculine, heavy, form-based sculpture of the time. He had to, risk being seen as absolutely ridiculous by just stretching a cord across the room. And yet, that's what he had pursued. And so much of what museums do is they allow the artist to take the risk for them, right? And I believe this is actually, on some level, it's the kind of Christian nature of museums, in the sense that the artist is the one who takes the burden for you, who basically will let himself be humiliated, you can say, or take the risk, so that you don't have to. And I actually think that I felt like what I wanted as a museum is to say, I want to put skin in the game as an institution too. And to actually, as an institution, to stand behind this work. And so that's probably the best explanation I have for why I felt like Fred Sandbach had to be the entire building. Because people could look at a gallery or a series of galleries and say, oh, that was a good or bad exhibition. But I felt like that what Fred Sandbach was doing was much more than making good art. Like, oh, that's a really good work of art. He was attempting to be something like what I would consider maybe more like a seer or prophet, someone, a shaman, someone who is actually like a spiritual being amongst us. And in doing so little, I like to say, he attempted to make it relevant to everything. In the fact that he took up so little space, it resonated with all the air around it. It's not just an object on the wall that you can then somehow contain. It wants to be somehow about what it means to just make a mark in the world. Right? He wants to be about the very act of making itself, the very act of just differentiating between, you could say, and I would like to say, the sacred and the profane. Maybe even like the transcendent and the mundane world. And I used to, and when I was doing this exhibition, I was organizing this exhibition, I weirdly thought a lot of my father, who had died about 10 years earlier. And I thought about it because, you know, here is somebody who was born in a house that, you know, had a dirt floor and didn't have heat, running water, or electricity. And here I was exhibiting a freaking artist who is just stretches string across the room. Like how decadent is that? Like, what he would think. He already thought that I was a complete screw up. And so he would really think that this was the worst. I thought about it a lot in preparing for this lecture. And I was hoping to be able to have some very, very articulate reason to be able to tell you why it was, in fact, that I felt that somehow to do something that is so little can feel like it is so much. And that act is the necessary counterpart to the feeling of the need to do something that's playful and maybe even ridiculous. I don't really have that exact, but I have a little bit closer to that exact understanding now. And it has to do with the fact that I really don't think that that it's about decadence in any way. Like, you know, decadence is the sort of the opulence of art. Like, we as a culture have evolved so much that we can appreciate these very refined differences in culture. And we've gone so far past meeting our simple needs as a culture that we can say, you know, the abstraction in this really does reverberate with a certain kind of naturalism. Like, the fact that we can say those kinds of things shows that we are a decadent culture, shows that we've got enough to eat, we've got shelter, we're okay. And then I realized that, like, no, actually, this is not the even further expression of decadence of art. This, you know, so much so that you can say, oh, the line stands for making shapes in a world that thinks of sculpture as actually form. This is about, you know, dividing space and not form, or some nonsense like that. Like, I feel like it's the opposite. I feel like what makes Fred Sandbeck interesting to me, he's actually returning to something very, very old about the role that maybe like a spiritual figure in a primitive or a non-traditional or traditional culture might actually play. The idea that actually somebody is taking on themselves to take a simple act, and with that simple act to differentiate what we all can then see as something special, something that is we recognize as sacred. And that's actually, to me, like the power of his work. But now, like, the question really was for me, like, I felt like that feels right to me about why I believe, that's why I believe in Fred Sandbeck, and what I would never, of course, argue my father, because he would never understand, but that's at least what I would sort of argue against him in my mind. But then there's this part of me that said, like, well, why is it that Fred Sandbeck's always sort of, that this exhibition feels so important as the necessary counterpart to all the silliness that I also believe in? And to me, like, at first it seemed the answer to that question was, well, maybe it's just the case that it's like nervous laughter. You have nervous laughter as a response to the fact that actually you take something so seriously, something touches you so much that you laugh. That maybe I actually believe in art so much that I have to have this nervous laughter response of actually being a little bit silly, a little bit ridiculous. And I think that that's partly true, but I think it's not quite entirely true. I actually think on some level, in some very simple, positive way, it's the ridiculous and it's even the comedy that is a way of getting at a kind of closer to something that I feel like is the sacredness and the meaning of art. That was one way of actually exploring that was an exhibition that I did alongside, or not alongside, but after. I did the Fred Sandbach, and that was an exhibition of works that looked a lot like this. Now, you might recognize this painting. This is by artist Kazimir Malevich. The Stedelijk owned this painting. They, because of questions about ownership, though, they had to sell it. It sold, turns out, for $60 million. And this painting is a painting that's not necessarily by Kazimir Malevich. This is a painting that a guy in Denver named Ron Pollard bought for about $600 off of eBay. And he keeps this painting and the 180 other ones in this bank vault. And he bought all of those paintings from a guy he met over eBay, who is a sort of insurance administrator in Aachen, Germany. And these works are, to my eye, extraordinary. He came to my office when I was still in Delmar, and he said, would you be interested in seeing my Malevich painting? And you're like, yeah, sure, I'll be interested in seeing your Malevich painting. And I was blown away. It looked really good. It was so amazing. It was so amazing that I decided to actually give these works an exhibition. And I exhibited them in this way that looks like you're at this museum, that gives them this air and boutique quality. So you feel like these are works of art that belong with the modern masters. We don't know whether these were painted by students of the masters. We don't know if they're forgeries made in the 1970s. We don't know if they were forgeries made yesterday. We don't know if they were students in the 1950s. We don't know anything about these works. The line is entirely broken. They are literally orphans in the world. So after I exhibited them at the museum, so there's one room that has these works with this incredible boutique quality to them, and the other room, they are hung salon style so that you can see like the massive display of them. So this was an exhibition that took a lot of courage for me because I felt like I was going to be like kicked out of any, you know, art museum directors club that would have had me, that I was going to be ridiculed by the field because museums simply don't show like works that are bought on eBay. But I felt like there's something about this exhibition that touched on the very, very heart and maybe even the very taboo of what it is that we value when we value art. How much does it matter that we know this was made by the hand of the master? If this painting looks exactly like a painting that was painted by the master himself, it has the same resonant effect on you. Like, what is that? What is the effect of knowing that it's painted by the master? I'm not saying there is none, but I just want to ask that as a question. We will be surprised on how much the knowledge of that this painting was painted by someone who we know to be a master, how that knowledge, the idea, that thought bleeds into our feelings, our ability to actually appreciate something. And therefore, the experience of art is even, we like to think of it as a pure experience of like, oh, that's amazing. But it's not pure. It's actually conditioned by all these sort of conventions that I think this exhibition gets to the very heart of. And it raises the question of what is authenticity? And I feel that in many ways, this exhibition Though I was terrified to do this exhibition, I was afraid that what my board would think, I was afraid what my peers would think. I believe it's probably the most important exhibition I did, and probably was the exact counterpart to the Fred Sandbach exhibition, who is the pure soul. Like, this is in many ways looking at the very taboo of the societal construction of art. I wrote a book about this process called From Russia with Doubt, and somebody thought it was number one. So that's awesome. Okay, so all of this, I want to have you, for me, it suggests a little bit of philosophy. And that philosophy is very beautifully articulated in the work of Felix Gonzalez Torres, his stack pieces, where he would just create these stacks of paper. You might know this work. There's two stacks, and you can take, and the visitors are allowed to take paper away. One of them says, somewhere better than this place. The other one says, nowhere better than this place. And that is another way of saying exactly what Joseph Beuys was saying with, like, yeah and nah. Like, that, the idea that there is somewhere better than this place, that art takes you out of this world. Art takes you to some spiritual place that you cannot have in your modern life, when you drive to your work and you to the gym and to your pick up the kids and come home. Like, art has to take you to this transcendent place. On the other hand, maybe there is no transcendence. Maybe art is another stop on the journey, and there is no place better than this place. And actually, all that is sacred is what is in front of us right here. This is sacred. There is no else to it. And I love the fact that the artist Felix Gonzalez Torres doesn't resolve those two. And that's exactly, actually, what I would say Fred Sandbach meant when he said that his art was about the utopian glimmerings between art and life. Utopian glimmerings between art and life. Because we like to think of art as being like, oh, it's this special sacred thing. But actually, I think that it's more of a glimmering. Its sacredness might appear to us at moments, and then we lose grasp of that thing. And we have to constantly work at it to make it happen for it, make it appear for us. And that's actually the work that I sort of see myself, that's the only thing that interests me as a museum director. And I continue at the MCA to go back and forth. I feel like the sense of play is to a sense of trying to do things that feel original and feel in that childlike way. So when we have a lecture like this, we would often give away free drinks in our cafe. But to redeem those free drinks, we would give people something like absurd. So, for example, like, sometimes we give them a polar bear, you know, who's wearing a T-shirt that says "Redeem for two free drinks" at the MCA cafe, and the polar bear would have to sit with the person in the audience. Or sometimes we give them this like a pylon that we found on the street, which is painted "Redeem for two free drinks" in the cafe, and then what's really funny is that, like, after we returned it to the street afterwards, like, we find it now all over the city in different places. we just had big sheet of foam, good for a half price meal, you know, and they'd have to, and then I was remember in the cafe when this person returned this, you know, so he's like redeeming his coupon for a half price meal, and it was funny because the person at the cafe was like, oh, okay, but like, it occurred to us all the time we've been doing this, like, we never told the cafe staff. They never thought, like, oh wait, we should tell them we're doing. So then the idea came to me that, wait, if we didn't tell the cafe staff and they're still doing it, like, we could do this to anybody. So we said, like, so the next week, we said, okay, we're going to take these two used tires and we're going to give away free tickets to the Denver Art Museum's King Tut exhibition, where people would just redeem these two used tires. So that actually ended the program. It was too far, just too far. But anyway, but you get what we're doing. Anyway, how are you doing? Here, we good? Okay, we have a few minutes left. So while as director, I oversee major exhibitions like this of Marilyn Minter or Barnaby Furnace. There is, in addition to like what will be like a part of what I would consider like the mainstream or the tradition of art, I'm always interested in going beyond what is even considered art right now. And I, when it feels like it's scary, that's when I feel like this is what I need to do. And that happens very, very powerfully for me when I did a recent exhibition, it was just 2 years ago, the retrospective of the artist Mark Mothersbaugh. This is me and him in 2011, I think. No, a little bit later than that. It took about 4 years to do the exhibition we did in 2014. Yeah, 2011. For those of you who don't know Mark Mothersbaugh, he was the lead singer of the band Devo. You know, whip it good. You got it. You know, if you don't know, just all you need to know is that people have Devo tattooed on their body. Okay, like that's how like legendary this band is for some people at least. And Mark has this enormous sense of play from the beginning of his career, from his art student in 1968, even through to the present. But that sense of play is actually has gravitas to it. The reason that they formed Devo, many people, actually I'm certain like a lot of people here will not probably know this, was that he was at Kent State University as an art student, 1970, and he was there when the National Guard opened fire on his friends, and they killed four of the students, and that's why they formed the art collective that they called Devo, because they believed the world was devolving, not evolving. And this art collective made films, they made art, they made poetry, and they made music until they ultimately became known as this, you know, a single band. I knew that this was a story that had to be told. When I talked to Mark, I went through four storage spaces filled with materials that had never been gone through before. We took a trip with him to Guadalajara to fabricate some works. Here we are in the Fabrica Ceramica Suro. And where he would make this sort of two-sided My Little Pony sculpture. But while in Guadalajara, Mark just likes to do other things. So, for example, he would had to stop off at the market. We had to ride home back to our hotel in a romantic horse carriage. He actually forgot his. He forgot the reason he's holding up a shirt is because he forgot his shirts. And there's a reception for him in Guadalajara, and so he had to go to the market, buy a new shirt at the market, and we were driving home in this horse and buggy while he's got his little zapata or whatever, like heroic t-shirt. A little story about working with Mark, because on the plane on the way back from Guadalajara, I went to the bathroom, and I noticed when I came back to my seat that he was fiddling with my bag. And I'm like, what are you doing? And I looked at my bag. I saw that he had messed around with my passport. And I was like, what are you doing with my passport? And I opened my passport, and he had actually put googly eyes on my passport. And I said to him, I was like, Mark, customs is not that chill, you know? They just are don't appreciate the jokes like you do. And anyway, so he thought that was real funny. Jimmy, this is not beside the point, though, because we talk all the time, by the way, as museums, all the time, educators, curators, directors. We learn from this artist. We learn from Andy Warhol that art and life are connected. But do we really learn from Andy Warhol that our life are connected? Do we learn? Do we do anything differently? And I was like, you know what? I want to learn from artists to play. I want to learn from artists to actually to constantly see the world as my playground in the same way that the artist does. And to live with Mark Mothersbaugh, an artist like Mark Mothersbaugh, was where I sort of really learn what, in fact, I was doing, what I had been doing, you know, ever since I'd been a curator, is I'm trying to assimilate more and more of the spirit of art. You know, it's so much of what we do as museum professionals is we care about art and we forget about its spirit. And so I want to care about the soul, not just the body. You know, in the exhibition we did of Mark, of course, you know, had this sort of its own elegance to it. It also had this incredible sense of play and childlike qualities to it. You know, he was able to expose all, make himself entirely vulnerable by letting us see all 30,000 of his, you know, postcard-sized drawings that he's done every single day of his life since he was a student. And so yeah, we need to make ourselves vulnerable too, I thought. You know, that's why we need to play too. We left the museum open all through the night. I gave a tour at 4 o'clock in the morning. My staff gave a tour at 5 in the morning. This is my exhibitions manager, Nick Solisi. But the more important thing is to actually take the lesson with us. You know, even though I'd been sort of always working on books, working on like proving again how serious and, you know, smart I am, I felt like I, after working with Mark Mothersbaugh on this exhibition, I actually decided to give up a book that I'd been writing. I went AWOL on another book. I told a literary agent that I had in New York who was selling a book, like, just don't worry about it anymore. And I started doing these conversations with my dog, with Christofferson. And now I'm working on a book called Talking with Christofferson About Clothing, and it's sort of a fashion, you know, conversation. Well, it's using clothing as a way of understanding culture and through conversations with Christofferson. But I think the important point is to be able to, like, is to be able to keep the spirit of art active sometimes, and which is more possible outside of art. And that's what we try to do as how we run an institution. To run an institution, to think about a museum is actually like a found object, something that we take, and then we determine how we're going to handle that found object. We can keep it intact, or we can manipulate it in various ways. We can be like artists ourselves like that. And then that's, this is a camel. On that note, should we take a few minutes of questions? A couple minutes? Okay, great. Yeah, that's it. Thank you. Yes, hello.
How did the public respond to the unconventional exhibits that you put on display?
Well, that's really interesting. Differently. So, like, Fred Sandbach was a total dud. I mean, like, nobody, like, liked it, and I don't care. Who cares? Like, I did it for myself, and it was great. It was. But the Russian paintings killed it. It was amazing. People loved it, and it was... And I didn't expect that either. And also, who cares? Like I loved it. No. I have the luxury of being in an institution that's small enough that if I'm doing something that feels right and authentic, I'm not. I don't have to be accountable to the audience as an indicator of success. But I would say that, like, it was really the Russian painting show was really, really successful, and the Mark Mothersbaugh show was really, really popular as well. It increased our visitation by about 50%. And I don't mean to be glib. I just mean to say that, like, I actually think that, like, we don't. I don't make decisions based upon that, even though I know that you don't. You weren't assuming that I did. Sorry. Yes.
Do you think that there might be a kind of Heisenberg principle at work when works of art, or what we consider to be works of art, come into an institutional context? For example, you do a show on X, Y, and Z. Do you think that there'd be any difference between your institution providing that context versus that stuff being shipped to, say, a local starving artist fair?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I do. I very much think. I think that another way of saying that is that meaning in art is extrinsic, not intrinsic. And I think that, and that's means that it's in play for us to make decisions about. But that means we have to do a lot of work, because you put something up on one wall. If you put a painting out there that's outside, if you put it up in this room, it would people would treat it differently. Even that simple change, because it clearly must not be that major a painting if we could be on these wood walls and not on those fancy white walls out there. I mean, these are fancy wood walls, but like you can get really close to it. Maybe that's a bad example. Anyway, yes, maybe your example is better. And the fact is, yes, I do believe that. And I think that I think that all those things matter, in the sense that I think that it's therefore possible to find ways to contextualize almost any art in a way that's interesting.
Well, I just wonder, pursuing that a little further, do you think that the museum itself, performs some kind of role in terms of creating the status of something?
Yes.
And therefore, in film industry parlance, I guess maybe you should get an executive producer credit.
Yeah, I think that we are taste makers. And we have a certain power within the arena of tastemakers. I have very little power, I think, as a tastemaker, because we're a small museum in Denver. I don't think that if I were to exhibit an artist, that anybody would care that much about it. But I think that different institutions have different degrees of power. Like Gagosian Gallery has a lot of power as a tastemaker, but yes, I agree with you. Yes, over here.
Can you talk about the lab and what course it took after you assumed the position?
Yeah, Mark basically created it as a platform for, because he really liked the ideas that he heard me talking about, and so therefore after 5 years of operating, it no longer made sense. He was supporting it entirely, and so therefore once there was this vacancy, and he was on the board of that organization as well, and it was just better for the city, better for everybody to not have all the energy that I was working on go outside, to bring it to the center of the city. And so we shuttered the lab and, took all the programming, the board. We merged the organizations, actually, formally, legally, into the MCA Denver.
Do you think that if you'd done the Sandbach, the most recent exhibit, rather than the first exhibit, that the reaction of the public would be different?
Yes, I do think so, because we would have built up more credibility, maybe. Maybe. And I'd say this is that, we also didn't we had no money when I took over the institution. We had, the building had a lot of debt. On it, and it's funny because, I don't want to talk about that, of course, only like the fun stuff. And so therefore we didn't have even like a marketing person. We didn't spend any money on communicating that we did this. And I think that it would have been very popular. I think it could have been very popular had we just been able to communicate more about it. Yeah, I think that's true. I think it's evolved, and I think that it's grown dramatically. It used to be, we used to have a much smaller audience, and now we have our Adam Pendleton exhibition this summer had lines around the block for the opening, and it's not like Adam Pendleton is a household name. So we actually have a lot of trust from our audience now as the place to go. So yes, thank you for helping me recover a sense of dignity. Thanks. Yes.
Do you think that your honest attitude about not needing the numbers to justify the program, do you think that has actually affected the success that you're now experiencing? The fact that you could, that wasn't a factor?
Yeah, I 100% agree. Did you all hear that? Because it was such a beautiful comment that I like want everyone to hear it forever. Because I really feel that because we're able to create a unified voice in the organization and to show things that we believe in, and we have a board that really is unified. And they're young. They're, you know, when I took over, they were all in their 40s, and now some people are creeping into their 50s, but it's a pretty like energetic, smart. I had a whole section of this talk about my board, you know, like because they're so awesome and crazy, and pictures of like one guy who has like a marijuana grow, his family has a marijuana grow facility, and another one who's he longboards to his private jet, another guy who, and I, but it's really the board who just they're interesting, smart, trusting people. And they said, Adam, like, we believe, you know, in what you're doing. And when that's done is that's created, I think, an authenticity to the program that gives it a natural gravitational pull. Like it's and therefore, like, we didn't have any money at the beginning, but we kept on building this program, and that created these, like, really hot coals, really, really hot coals. So as soon as we actually started to become financially stable, and we were able to invest in, like, we hired a marketing guy, all of a sudden that just put oxygen on it, and now it sort of exploded, and that's why, you know, people scalp tickets to our openings, you know, and that's why, like, our lectures, you know, are selling out week after, you know, we have to turn away people to feminism and mixed days lectures, and that's crazy. Wait, over here.
Your use of camels and pigeoneers and magicians and so forth, is this meant, are they presented as art forms of themselves, or is it in as adjuncts to something that's going on, a different aspect that reflects?
Thank you. So is this art? So, you know, I don't claim mixed taste is art. What I claim, though, is that it does the work that all art tries to do. And that is that I think all art tries to get you to think, to see the world with a fresh perspective, right? So therefore, like, let's say if I were to ask you, like, oh, where do you want to go to dinner tonight? I bet you your mind will automatically go to the places that you always go for dinner. Because our mind naturally goes into patterns. If I say, think of a place you want to go for dinner tonight that begins with A, then tomorrow B, then the next day C, you'll be forced your mind out of its traditional patterns by imposing that arbitrary sort of system of the alphabet. And that's the work that we all need to do, I think, to actually the most important work to make a better society is to get out of our patterns. And I think that's exactly what mixed taste does. By putting these things arbitrarily together, it forces a new perspective on both of them. And therefore you enter into like a freshness of seeing things. And that's, I think, the goal of art, is to create its own world, therefore forces you out of your world on some level. And so I'm not making any claims for it being art. So wait, can I just then we'll get back to you then. Sorry.
Mikhail Bakhtin, Fabulani and His World.
Yes.
Carnivalesque, Bodily Lower Stratum.
Yeah.
Influence on your conception.
Yeah, you know, I used to love Bakhtin and the Carnivalesque. You know, for me, the perspective that goes into, and I'm going to geek out here because thank you, because I still haven't finished paying off my student loans. Is more like this Nietzschean division between the Apollonian and the Dionysian. And so Nietzsche, as some of you probably know, his very first book, Birth of Tragedy, he sets out this distinction between the Apollonian, which was rational, and that he says all knowledge in Western culture is sort of usually focused on the Apollonian, the rational, and I would say this form, and that would be like science would be the Apollonian. And then on the other side, there's the Dionysian, and we've sort of forgot about that. Like, but that actually used to be a form of knowledge. It's the chaotic, it's the drunkenness. And his whole career, he spent trying to marry those two, the Apollonian and the Dionysian. And actually, I remember I read the book, like, one of my first semester in college, and it's it continues to haunt me. And one of the things that's always haunted me is the fact that art was actually, or sculpture for Nietzsche, was in the Apollonian, not the Dionysian. And that is really interesting because form is Apollonian. And I always say, like, okay, when you've got a painting, when you've got a sculpture, you've got form, and therefore you've got something that actually has stability. Don't think you've got chaos. You've got to create the chaos. That's actually why, like, I always say, like, we need to make sure that we add that chaos. That's always a part of the art-making process that you feel in a studio. That's why you feel like, energized. That's why you feel, like, more awake when you're seeing an artist's studio, because it feels like you're excited to make something yourself. It's like that's the kind of drunken, because you're actually a little bit drunk on that kind of creativity. But I think museums, they tend to focus on the form. And I think that the question always has to be, how do we add back in a little bit of the chaos, a little bit of the unknown? And that's actually why I'm very positive, even though I don't drink anymore, I'm very positive about making sure that we allow those events of drinking in the museum, because I feel like it's important to add back in that level of chaos. That's why it's important to have those kinds of the camel in the museum. You know, it's important to add that level of chaos back in, because then the erotics of art are come back together, like come back to become present again to our visitors, and that's what gives it that energy. So, yeah.
And literally, it'd be Adam Lerner riding the Apollonian. Right?
So we take this back to Hegel for you.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Awesome.
And you want us to go back with
yes.
Of Heisenberg, yes.
Yeah. I set myself up for it, but you guys are amazing. I love it. It's great having it. Yes, sir.
Just to follow up on that line of thought, as it were, speaking of Dionysus in 2017, since pot is legal, do you find that a large portion of your visitors
are stoned?
Especially drunk.
It makes it that hard to get booked another board meeting, I can say that much. I think that I do feel like what it's done is it's created. I do think that we have a more permissive culture, and I think that the legalization of marijuana in Colorado actually is part of a little bit more of that permissiveness. Like, how does it affect our audience? I don't know. Of course, pot. Like, I don't know. I don't really consider pot a drug. I mean, most of our audience is not, like, way worse than pot, you know, not just marijuana.
Wondering, are people spending more time, kind of staring, breaking?
Oh, right. Yeah.
Is there more clarity?
Yeah.
When they encounter the camel?
I don't know. Maybe. I know certainly with our board that is the case. They're definitely more engaged in the art. I wish I knew. Like Cheech Marin actually asked me this question at a conference, and which is pretty awesome. So you're in good company. But he asked me, like, how does it affect you personally? Which I thought was funny. And I just said, like, well, I guess it just makes it easier to buy marijuana. But even though I don't do that. But I do feel like there's something about, I just to go back maybe to the issue that I really want to talk about is maybe that's actually an important role for culture, because again, is like, what are the safe areas of chaos is one way of thinking about it. And I think that a museum could be a little bit of a safe area for chaos. And then I think alcohol is a horrible form of chaos in a culture by comparison to a lot of other drugs, because it's really dangerous. Even though it can add that chaos, I think that marijuana is actually much less debilitating in a lot of ways. And it's a safer way of form of chaos. But that's just a personal opinion, and other people might disagree. I think the more important issue is actually, like, how do we create in our culture forms of chaos that actually are productive? That's where I want to actually say, and forget about everything else I said.
That's
a good place. That's a good place to end. Okay.